Our headlines: North Korea says the situation on the Korean Peninsula is growing more unstable due to, quote, reckless military hysteria of U.S. and South Korea. A new report says the U.S. National Security Advisor has held talks with Russian officials to prevent the Ukraine war from escalating into a nuclear conflict. And humanitarian groups accuse Italy of breaking international law by refusing to let in migrants plucked from the sea, pledging legal action against Rome. Hello and welcome, and thank you for joining us. The top story this hour: North Korea has vowed a, quote, sustained, resolute, and overwhelming military response to the recent joint air drills by South Korea and the United States. The North Korean military said the war games were an open provocation aimed at intentionally escalating the tension. It added the exercises were dangerous and of very high aggressive nature. The military noted that the situation grows more unstable due to what it called reckless military hysteria of Seoul and Washington. Last week, South Korea and the United States carried out their largest ever air drills for 6 days. Hundreds of warplanes, including U.S. B-1B bombers, participated in the exercises. Washington and Seoul cited the drills were in response to Pyongyang's launches of missiles and its possible plan to resume nuclear tests. Pyongyang, however, viewed the drills as a rehearsal for an invasion.
Sirens going off in South Korea. Another salvo of North Korean ballistic missiles fired. This is part of Pyongyang's testing blitz. A new annual record for missile launches was set back in June. And just this week, 23 missiles were launched in a single day, setting a new daily record. U.S. officials have indicated that North Korea is ready to conduct a nuclear test at any time. Let's not forget, these missiles have the ability to reach U.S. soil, specifically California. Meanwhile, Washington and Seoul have conducted their biggest ever Air Force drills. North Korea's firing of intercontinental ballistic missiles, and more U.S. war games. A dangerous and volatile concoction, a war scenario which, if it were true, would involve nuclear weapons. That was evident from the U.S. side, when the U.S. Air Force deployed the two B-1B long-range heavy bombers on the final day of the military exercises. This was the first time B-1Bs have flown to the Korean Peninsula since December 2017. So why is Pyongyang on the offensive? Even though the missile launches grabbed all the attention, less notice were developments in the North Korean nuclear doctrine. In September, North Korea updated a 2013 law setting out its nuclear weapons policies and announced that it would respond to attacks against its nuclear command and control systems by launching a nuclear strike automatically and immediately.
The fundamental mission of our nuclear forces is to deter a war. But our nukes can never be confined to the single mission of war deterrent, even at a time when a situation we are not desirous of at all is created on this land.
The U.S. and its allies in this region better be careful. Even an accidental targeting of anything in North Korea could signal a dangerous reaction, and that could spell nuclear Armageddon.
The view from the White House and U.S. allies in the region is that Pyongyang is looking for, quote-unquote, attention. They believe that North Korea is deliberately ramping up tensions with its neighbors to ultimately call for engagement and concessions from South Korea, Japan, and the United States. Yet there are doubts if that is really the case. Maybe another message is for the U.S. to leave that region altogether.
North Korea's barrage of missiles is sending the U.S. another message other than military and missile capabilities. North Korea has been under severe U.S. sanctions. For starters, it has sanctioned properties and belongings of the Workers' Party of Korea. Freezing the property of members of the Workers' Party of Korea essentially amounts to stealing from everyday Koreans, as the party's membership stands at 6.5 million people, or a quarter of North Korea's population. Harsh U.S. bilateral and U.N. sanctions have had particularly devastating effects on the North Korean economy. The list of industries directly targeted include the mineral trade, seafood, textiles, and agricultural products. Previous talks between the U.S. and North Korea hinged on the elimination of these sanctions, in return for Pyongyang to stop its ballistic nuclear program. But the U.S. was not willing to give any concessions, resulting in a stalemate. Meanwhile, the U.S. believes that China and Russia have the leverage to persuade North Korea not to resume nuclear bomb testing. But why should they do that, given the Ukraine conflict and how U.S. feels about Russia and U.S.'s appetite for confrontation with China, either militarily or when it comes to trade? This idea seems far-fetched. Perhaps a grand bargain can be reached between U.S., Russia, and China when it comes to North Korea, if the desire is there before it is too late. And as far as U.S. foreign policy goes, it has failed in many respects. When it comes to countries like Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, Syria, well, the list is long. The current U.S. President Joe Biden, like many of his predecessors, has failed to execute a clear diplomatic path to reach solutions, opting instead for provocation and military aggression.
China warned Switzerland not to adopt restrictive measures against Beijing over alleged human rights violations. The Chinese ambassador to Switzerland said relations between Beijing and Bern will soar if Switzerland follow the EU by imposing sanctions on China. Wang Xieting urged Switzerland to act responsibly and not agree to the EU bans over alleged human rights abuses. Switzerland has not decided to follow the EU's lead yet, but the neutral country has spoken more openly about rights violations in China. The Swiss government, however, has attached importance to bilateral relations with China, which is its biggest trading partner in Asia. A U.S. media report says top American and Russian officials have held talks aimed at lowering the risk of a nuclear spillover in the Ukraine war. According to the Wall Street Journal, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan held confidential conversations with two Kremlin officials in recent months. The report says the talk have not been made public without providing details about the time or the number of calls. Washington has refused to comment on the report. Over the past weeks, nuclear tensions simmered between Russia on one side and the U.S. and Ukraine on the other. Moscow accused Kiev of planning to use a radioactive dirty bomb. Ukraine denied the accusation when its allies were found, saying that Moscow searching a pretext to use its own nukes. And Russia warned against a U.S. plan to speed up the deployment of its upgraded nuclear weapons to NATO bases in Europe. Nearly 10 months into the Russia-Ukraine war, fierce fighting rages between forces of two countries in Ukraine's east. Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky says the Russian military is continuing its, quote, fierce attacks on the Donetsk region. In a video address, Zelensky said the Russian army is concentrating its forces and means for a possible repetition of attacks on Ukrainian infrastructure, with energy sector being its prime target. Zelensky, however, claimed Moscow was suffering serious losses there. Meanwhile, reports coming out of the Russian-held southern region of Kherson indicate that strategic Novokakhovka Dam has been hit by a Ukrainian strike. In the city of Kherson, water and power supplies have been cut by what local authorities say was an act of sabotage and blames it on Ukraine. Our Ukraine correspondent, Johnny Miller, joined us earlier for more about the latest developments in the region of Kherson. Let's take a listen.
Well, there's been a major offensive that's been warned about for weeks now by Ukraine on the city of Kherson. Of course, Kherson, a vitally strategic city, it's the capital of the Kherson region, one of the four regions that Russia has taken over. One of the main reasons Russia has taken over the Kherson region and the Zaporozhye region is to safeguard Crimea. Of course, Crimea is vitally important to Russian interests. I've seen many videos over recent weeks of Ukraine launching small attacks on Kherson, those being repulsed by Russia. But there has been huge warnings of a major, major attack on Kherson. There's conflicting reports about whether Russia will be able to hold on to Kherson. I spoke to a journalist recently who just returned. He said there's no way Ukraine will take Kherson. Russia is turning it into a fortress. Although I have heard some other reports that Russia is already planning to withdraw from the city. Interestingly, the Russian flag was taken down off the main administration center a few days ago. Other Russian flags stayed in place. And Ukraine also put out a statement saying that they think that Russia is trying to lure them into a trap in Kherson. So we'll have to wait and see whether this expected offensive is going to happen on Kherson.
Anger is simmering over Italy's refusal to let in migrants plucked from the sea. A German rescue charity organization says it will take legal action against the Italian government for violating international law. The organization says it will file petition in courts in two Italian cities of Rome and Catania, that after Italy barred around 200 migrants to get off a rescue ship in Catania. Prior to that, Italian authorities let in 144 vulnerable passengers on board a German-flagged vessel while refusing to accept others. Those allowed to disembark were children and the sick. The ship was then ordered to leave the port of Catania. Italy is now facing criticism for its selective approach toward receiving migrants. Human rights groups has called on Rome to stop discrimination. They say the law of the sea requires that all rescued migrants should be disembarked in a safe place. With congressional midterm elections just days away in the U.S., polls show a vast majority of the American people fear that a period of political violence looms in the country. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the potential for such unrest.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. U.S. President Joe Biden and his predecessors, Democrat Barack Obama and Republican Donald Trump, are sounding the alarm over threats to American democracy as the countdown starts to the congressional midterm elections. Three men converged on Pennsylvania Saturday to push their parties to the finishing line. Biden said the race marks a defining moment for U.S. democracy. Obama echoed Biden's warning, saying the stakes are high as democracy is on the ballot. At the same time, Obama attacked Republicans for becoming increasingly averse to everything from science to respect for rules, and Trump blamed Biden for turning the country into a police state. Americans will be going to the polls on Tuesday to decide who will control Congress during the final 2 years of Biden's first term. This, as a vast majority of the American people fear that the country will go through a period of political violence. Rami Mazahari joins us from Chicago to tell us the latest on this. And Don DeBar is an activist and commentator joining us to break this down for us. Rami Mazahari, it's good to talk to you finally on this topic, because really curious as to what's going on there in the States. What can you tell us?
Good to talk to you, Kaveh. Much appreciated. It's certainly something that has been dominating the headlines here in the past week, due to the attack on the husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. But before we get to that, you know, I'd like to just bring up a few statistics and points that kind of show how deep the fear is here of election-related violence. There is a new poll that seemingly all the news media are talking about. 9 out of 10 Americans are afraid of politically motivated violence. That's really a stunning, stunning amount. You're talking about almost everybody, 9 out of 10 people. And I can say that, you know, just from my experience, I'm here in Chicago, the third largest city, and I have been downtown, right downtown on the what they call the Magnificent Mile, and trying to get the, you know, man on the street interviews, and it's very difficult. People just don't even want to talk about the election because it's just so divisive, and there's just so much fear about it. Going back to that poll, the blame is basically totally equal. Republicans blame Democrats for stoking the violence. Democrats blame Republicans, and then another third blame both parties equally. So I think it's just it's really sort of clear to everyone that both parties are to blame, that neither party is has put together any sort of platform based around unity, based around genuine patriotism. And so this is just sort of very reflective of where the United States is at in this moment. And it's a moment that goes back really 6 years. There's another interesting statistic. There have been 10 times the number of threats against members of Congress than there were just 5 years ago. And that's when you really have to go back to see when this sort of, you know, I don't want to be hyperbolic, but somehow, you know, sort of a pre-Civil War kind of a state has existed. You have to go back to 2016, the arrival of the corrosive Donald Trump, then the simultaneous arrival of the equally corrosive repression of his supporters has really shown the United States to have a political culture that is plagued by, perhaps above all, self-righteousness, but also anger and violence. And it's really only gotten worse. A recent extensive survey showed that a third of Americans believe that political violence is usually or always justified. Now, America is about the least likely country to have a socialist revolution, that's socialist-inspired revolution, that's going to put the 99%, the working poor class, on top. So what they're talking about really here with this one-third of political violence is basically just to run over the other guy, run over the, you know, opposite team. So it's really indicative of where this country is at.
Uh-huh. Don DeBar, I saw you shaking your head a lot when our correspondent was talking there. What's on your mind?
Let's start with the poll.
Sure.
I assume that what we're talking about is the Washington Post ABC poll that came out a few days ago. It's a sample of 700 and some odd people. The Washington Post is owned by Jeffrey Bezos, who has a 700 plus million dollar contract with the CIA. The idea of political violence paralyzing the political system here, and that the Republicans and or Trump and or supporters constitute some kind of existential threat to an American democracy that in my 68 years living here I've yet to witness, is right off the CIA's page. So, you know, there's a margin of error plus or minus 4.5% in that particular poll, if that's what we're talking about. It shows, by the way, that there's a slight majority of people who want to see the Republicans take both houses. And there's the deepest divisions are over issues like abortion, climate change, and violence in the cities, quote unquote, you know, the crime. This is in the face of, right now, we're looking down the barrel of World War III. You know, the U.S. government and Zelensky in Ukraine are back and forth about whether or not the U.S. should take a military action against Iran. We're finding out that the U.S. has boots on the ground in Ukraine. They can't use the word advisors because they'd get laughed off the pages of Vietnam's history book. But they're saying that they're there to count weapons out of one side of their mouth, and on the other side saying there's been no diversion of the $50-plus billion worth of weapons that we put there. No one's afraid of political violence here. This is a media hype. So I don't buy any of this, and I have some considerable experience in it myself.
Ramin, thank you for the update on that, and thank you for the breakdown there, Don DeBar. We appreciate it. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
That's a wrap for this hour's World News. Thank you for your company. Stay with us.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the Limelight.
Many British households will struggle to pay energy bills this winter. Britain is facing a severe energy crisis exacerbated by anti-Russian sanctions and a sharp decrease in Russian energy supplies. Meanwhile, the Met Office has said that the probability that Britain will face a colder than usual winter is slightly higher than normal. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT had a look on this issue riding amid a looming energy crisis. Meteorologists say the chances of lower temperatures are 1.3 times higher than normal in Britain. The probability that Britain will face a colder than usual winter is slightly higher than normal, the Met Office said recently in a three-month forecast. As the country braces for an energy crisis exacerbated by anti-Russia sanctions and a sharp decrease in Moscow's energy supplies to Europe, meteorologists say there is a 25% chance the upcoming season will be cold, which is 1.3 times the usual chance. At the same time, the Met Office said that the chances of dry conditions are greater than normal, while stormy conditions are less likely than normal. Overall, however, the most likely scenario is that the upcoming winter will be an average one, according to the outlook. October in Britain was unusually warm, with temperatures last weekend going above 20 degrees Celsius. The mild weather means there hasn't been as much a spike in energy demand, and gas prices have actually decreased from their summer peaks. Nevertheless, Britain is preparing for a challenging winter, despite not being directly dependent on Russian energy supplies. The UK used to import gas and electricity from continental Europe during the coldest months and extreme weather events. However, this year, European countries are facing severe energy crises of their own amid attempts to rid themselves of dependency on Russian fuel. Late last month, Centrica PLC announced that it was reopening North Sea-based Rau, the country's biggest gas storage facility, after a five-year suspension. Though it will be operating at only around 20% of its former capacity, it will still add 50% to the UK's reserves. Britain's National Grid, ESO, said in October that its base case remains unchanged, suggesting there will be enough gas and electricity for Britain this winter. However, it didn't rule out a more extreme scenario involving a hypothetical escalation of energy crisis in Europe and a deficit in gas, as well as in electricity supplies. In this case, mitigation strategies are expected to be launched, including dispatching the retained coal units. ESO head John Pettigrew also revealed a worst-case scenario. If the weather turns extremely cold and if gas supplies to feed power stations are insufficient, the company will have to switch off gas and electricity in parts of the country for a few hours at a time. Financial Times also reported The head of National Grid has warned that many British households would find this winter financially very, very hard, despite government support to limit the rise in gas and electricity bills. John Pettigrew, the chief executive of the company that oversees Britain's electricity and gas systems, told the Financial Times he was under no illusions about the struggles many people would face during the colder months, despite a universal subsidy on all domestic energy bills until April. Even with a taxpayer-funded price cap, this is a doubling up of what people are used to paying for their energy bills. Therefore, inevitably, there are going to be people who are going to struggle. The government has capped the unit cost of energy until April, which would mean a typical household would pay about £2,500 on average over a year. But last winter, the equivalent figure was £1,277 each. Household will also receive a £400 rebate on energy bills with additional means-tested payments through social security benefits. But charities have warned the help will not be enough to avoid 7 million households, or a quarter of all homes, experiencing dire fuel poverty. Pettigrew said that when the support ended in April, a more targeted scheme to help those households in the most need seemed the best solution. Something like a social tariff makes a lot of sense. Pettigrew's call mirrors that of some big energy suppliers, such as Scottish Power, that have been pushing the government to set up a subsidized social energy package that would apply to the most vulnerable customers. Pettigrew was speaking ahead of the announcement that National Grid was setting up a £50 million fund to cover the next 18 months, which it will distribute to organizations such as the Fuel Bank Foundation and Citizens Advice that assist households struggling with the cost of living crisis. Although National Grid does not supply electricity or gas, it receives a proportion of all bills to pay for the management of the energy grids and oversee the country's electricity and gas systems. These so-called network charges, which are distributed among a number of companies, make up about 10 pair of a domestic bill. Simon Francis of the End Fuel Poverty Coalition said energy companies were fast recognizing they had a moral obligation to step in and help struggling households. Pettigrew insisted that National Grid, which made underlying profits of £4 billion during the year to March 31st, was not launching the fund to try to head off a potential backlash against the energy industry as the cost of living crisis spirals. Pettigrew said the energy price crisis, which was exacerbated by the Russia-Ukraine crisis, was bigger than any one individual company can address. And what we are trying to do is to be responsible and play our part. He, who was paid £6.5 million last year, added that the company in May announced it was returning £200 million to bill payers after generating strong earnings from the import and export of power to other European countries via subsea cables. National Grid in October warned households to prepare for the possibility of rolling blackouts this winter if, in the unlikely scenario, Britain couldn't import sufficient energy from continental Europe during periods of high demand. Pettigrew said the company's base scenario was for the country to have sufficient supplies to meet demand this winter. He added that unseasonably warm this winter in recent weeks had helped countries in the EU to fill their gas storage facilities as there had been less demand for heating purposes.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, brothers and sisters from all around the world You are listening my voice from IRIB English Radio And today I have the honor to be the host of today's episode I am Beta at your service And with me I have two dear guests Brother Ali, hello, how are you doing?
Assalamu alaikum, thank
Assalamu alaikum.
You for inviting me, it's a pleasure to
it's
be here
It's a pleasure for me too And Brother Amit here
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. So we're going to go through our topic today. As you know, all the women around the world are somehow different and making hijab or something like that. But one of the most important signs of Islamic women and Muslims who are women is hijab. And we are known around the world by our hijab and the way we are appear in the society, actually. So the thing is, actually, even in Islamic countries that hijab is somehow an obligation here, there is kind of, as you know, there are two groups here in women, actually, society. One group is the people who are committed to hijab and they are just covering themselves completely in a way that they should, actually, in a way the guidelines that tell you that you have to be. But there are another group that, are like, okay, we're not going to accept this, but because there is an obligation, we wear a scarf. Not in a way that they tell us, and not in a complete way, but just we wear it just not to break the rules. And actually, the thing I want to ask you is that why should be somehow a kind of judgment about these people who just don't wear hijab in a complete way? You know, it's like, okay, if you don't wear hijab, you are more... you are more person that will commit to sin in this society. Why there is a kind of atmosphere about these people in this society?
Look,
this is my question.
No one, sister, is going to judge about the people. I mean, at least we people are not allowed to judge about the people. To
we
say
are not allowed,
this person,
but
for example, who is observing hijab is a good person, or the one who is not observing hijab is a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
You see, we see that, not observing hijab by itself is sort of, let's say, sin, if we can call it, let's say, a social sin, right?
Yeah.
But anyhow, we can actually put it under a category of sins, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a person like her or like him doesn't observe hijab, so he or she committed a sin. But me as a person, for example, who observes hijab may commit hundreds of sins, right?
Yeah.
But my sins are hidden and her sin or his sin is shown.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you have come across some people that actually are judging people like that, we are, in case they are, I mean, coming with rude, let's say, behavior to judge people, we have to tell them directly, do you understand Islam? Did Islam ask you to judge people in that way that you are talking about? So and Islam by itself never asked us to judge people in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And no one has the right to judge people in this way. Okay, she has, let's say, a deficiency in herself. I have too many of those deficiencies inside myself, right?
Yeah.
So we have to be careful that Islam actually wants to keep these, let's say, borders for ourselves. Because we are Muslims, but we are not allowed to downgrade and, let's say, to belittle people.
Yeah.
No, people are respected. And their lives, and specifically Muslims, their lives, their blood, everything is respected and it has to be respected. In case a person like commits a sin, maybe this person who is not observing hijab today would be among the ones who is one of the best practitioners of hijab in the future.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
And to add to that, you see, policing is, we have to put a distinction between judgment and policing. Judgment is when you look at one person and you say, okay, he is either a good person or a bad person. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Just by looking at the hijab, you see, a good person, a bad person is not like a binary, it's not a binary phenomenon where you say it's zero or one.
Mm-hmm.
A person might not wear the hijab, but also do very good things. At the same time, a person wearing the hijab and also do other bad things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not one, life is not one dimensional where it's just one thing or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's very, diverse. There are many, even the Supreme Leader, he also mentioned the same point, rather. He said that the problem with the ones who do not wear hijab properly, their problem is apparent, but our problem is unapparent.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
more hidden inside us. They're still our sisters. They're still our mothers. They're still our brother, our daughters, right?
Yeah.
And we have to. And at the same time, we put a distinction between judgment and policing and doing the amr al-maruf and nahi al-munkar.
Yeah, yeah.
You see, when you approach a young girl not wearing proper hijab, and then you tell her, please, you know, consider this social aspect. They come back and tell you, why are you judging me? We're not judging you. We're suggesting you something better.
But the way you suggest us, the way you suggest the young generation is not somehow appropriate. I want to tell you
that. So tell me, how should I suggest you?
Because there is an opposition. There is a kind of deep hatred in my generation about, I don't know, some limitations. I don't want to call them limitations, but we see them as limitations, okay? And there are an opposition. And this opposition, the root of this opposition is exactly this one. Mm. You know, when you tell us to do something, you have to be so delicate, but you are not, you know, and I'm not talking about
that.
You actually I'm talking about generally,
and that is true. And I'm not rule when you're suggesting something,
like something
we
special
have.
You know, they're like, okay, you
the like
you know,
you and the like.
Okay. And it's like, okay, you have to wear hijab. Mm. Okay,
you see, we have this this ahkam of amr al maruf, as you know, this enjoining the truth and enjoining the right. This, you see, there is ways of doing this. There is ways of doing this, and I understand that sometimes in the society there are people who execute it in a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
That is wrong, completely wrong. It shouldn't be done. We are against that as well. Right?
So why, for example, when it comes to hijab, you are like, okay, you know, there are eyes, okay, it doesn't matter that much. We are always true, but when it comes to something, which somehow there is a paradoxical content in that, you are like, okay, I know it's not true, but what can we do for that?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that much paradoxical?
I want to agree with you 100%. Now,
really?
Let me why. Let me tell you why.
It's so surprising now.
Yeah, I do agree with her. Because, you know, sister, in this country, let's talk about our country first.
Mm-hmm.
I think we really, as you said, we did not act well in this regard. Look, for one issue 20 years ago, actually, we worked very beautifully and culturally on one issue, that is fastening the seatbelt. You know, in 20 years ago, we made lots of motion graphics and lots of videos and, let's say, games. And now we see that in our society, plenty of people observe this fastening of the seatbelt of their cars, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it means that if we work culturally on the minds of the people and show the importance of that, so they are the people who accept. Because I think, to my own understanding, I do believe in this statement of Imam Khomeini rahmatullahi, that said, our people, our nation is much more better than the nation of the Holy Prophet. You see? Mm-hmm.
That is true.
I do agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because these people actually tolerated lots of sanctions, embargoes, and pressures from different sides for 40 years and even more, but they are still resistant. But in the issue of hijab, I think we did not act well. I do agree with you. Because, you know, there are almost 90 different, let's say, organizations who are responsible for these issues, but none of them acted well. The only organization that was active, it was the police. That, look, when one in a body, when only one part of your body is growing, it's like, let's say, cancerous growth. You see, it means that, for example, the hand of a body is growing, but the other parts of the body are not growing.
Exactly.
Right. So only this police issue, this police, let's say, center has improved and actually promoted its activities with regard to the hijab and hijab issues. Yes, we were actually, we did not work on that well. Because
so
we could actually work and show the importance of it through, let's say, videos in this time that we are living through media, through social media, from, I don't know, not by speeches anymore, let's say. Because people today are not the people of listening to the speeches as much as before.
No,
right?
I differ that, because there are people who listen. It should be in always speeches and non-speeches.
For the younger generation, I can tell you, even the speeches that are in short, let's say, portions, I think, can work here. So through, I think, good language, let's say, different media, different, let's say, genres of art and, let's say, different, let's say, methods, we can mm-hmm. actually work on the minds of our youngsters because they are our investment of the future, right? So we are losing that capital of ours.
Isn't it too late to correct this?
Look, sister, you know, I'm as a critic of this issue. I was not a person who is responsible. Look,
yeah,
a person who is a director of a movie mm-hmm. can direct that movie well, but he cannot. But he's not necessarily a good, let's say, player of that movie, right?
Yeah.
You see, we can criticize well, and this is good, for example, to be listened by those who are responsible, who have, let's say, status in this government.
But those who are responsible won't do anything.
What is the reason? The reason is that me and you and others have stopped doing Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar. That is when we stay silent and we do nothing. So this is the result. Mm-hmm. I remember once, actually, I was going to my hometown in a bus. The bus was almost 40 people. I think I have told it to you, huh?
I can't remember.
It was almost, again, more than 10 to 15 years ago. Look, it was morning time and wanted to pray for the morning Fajr prayer. And it was raining again outside. But I asked the driver to stop somewhere for praying. He said that, okay, you are the only one who is going to pray. Keep it at home. I mean, do your praying at home while we reach there. I don't know. Look, bro, it will be 11 when we reach home. Then there would be no Fajr prayer for me because it will be Qadha then.
Yeah.
You know, by... It was astonishing that even some people who had, let's say, a sort of religious appearance, they started to disagree with me. That say, okay, yeah. No, don't go for prayer because it's raining and it will. I mean, you will actually put us. You will make us stuck, right? So it would take our time, and then we will not forgive you if you go and pray.
See? Yeah, I've never seen that in that perspective.
This is not only the sin of the person who is there. This is my sin, your sin, my fault, your fault, his fault, that we stay silent and we say, okay, they are not going to listen.
Mm-hmm.
No, if you tell him, suppose that, for example, you're moving in the street and you find a person who is doing a mistake. You are the first one. You don't let's say, quarrel her or him. Just tell her or him that, this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this person might react or might not react. Again, the second person comes and tells her or him, this is wrong. Again, if 3-4 people come to him, it definitely affects the person. Don't doubt that it will affect.
Yeah.
Let me add to that. He was talking about the methodology of Amr al-Ma'ruf. You see, there are certain things that you really can't solve with, you know, simple just saying it. You know,
mm-hmm.
We have in the Ahkam itself, the way you approach Amr al-Ma'ruf is not necessarily just by speaking.
Yeah.
Once, if you're a father and you have a 7-year-old child and that child steals something from someone, you do adab. You know, kind of not only just speak to that child, you quarrel with that child. Right. Why did you steal? You're 7 years old. By the time you become 70, you're going to be a gangster. You're going to be the head of the gang group who steals everything from the people. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's one step. Now, if you don't have that ability, then what about just by speaking? Right?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have that ability and you know that it's not going to work out, just by, you know, with, you know, actions and stuff. Like, for example, the story of Imam Hussein and Imam Hassan, when they saw this old man who wasn't making his wudu properly, they approached, they didn't say, oh, old man, you're not doing your wudu properly. Let me show you how to make the wudu. No. Just judge between us who makes a better wudu.
Yeah.
He realized. Right?
You know, thank you. Just, you know, I'm really curious right now, you know, because as you were just telling me that, okay, there are good ways to do things. There are ways, actually, if you have any kind of, any confusion about anything, you have to tell it. You have freedom in your, you know, telling anything. But in your actions and whatever else, you have to be more, you have to pay more attention to that sort of things. And you are free to think, you are free to search and you are free to ask, but you are not free to do anything you want. And
exactly.
I really think, you know, actually, I really appreciate your conversation. And I think I'm convinced somehow. I wish our listeners who are enjoying our conversation too. And that was all for the 2-day episode. Thank you, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. Farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept Al-Habib. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها لنا يوم القيامة. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها شفاعة أنا لها.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Since Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's crown prince in 2017, the kingdom has detained hundreds of activists and human rights defenders, as well as bloggers, academics and others for their political activism, showing nearly zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnation of the crackdown on these people. Muslim scholars, particularly Shiite clerics and human rights activists from the Shia communities, have been executed, and women rights campaigners have been imprisoned and tortured, as freedom of expression, relationship between groups and their beliefs continue to be denied by the Saudi authorities. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The English website of Fast News Agency reports, an international human rights organization warned against the appalling conditions of human rights in Saudi Arabia and the brutal forms of physical and mental torture that state authorities use against imprisoned political dissidents and pro-democracy campaigners. The European Saudi Organization for Human Rights said in a report that Saudi citizens are subject to all kinds of torture ever since they're arrested under trumped-up charges, and the torments do not stop even after rulings are passed and include the families and relatives of the detainees as well. The group added that Saudi officials carry out various types of mental and physical torture against the detainees who later face the death penalty. They are severely beaten and forcibly disappeared for long periods of time during detention. The European Saudi Organization for Human Rights went on to note that Saudi authorities make use of different methods of physical torture, including electric shocks, sleep deprivation, beatings, extraction of nails from fingers, and hanging from the feet to force the imprisoned activists into signing confessions. The human rights organization pointed to the case of Saudi teenager Mustafa al-Darwish, who was executed in June of 2021 and was forced to sign a confession under the threat of a retrial. Apart from physical torture, the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights has observed the use of psychological torture against a number of detainees, including threats to their families. Haider Al-Leif, a protester who was executed on 23rd of April 2019, was threatened that if he did not sign the confession, his wife would be summoned to prison to divorce him. According to the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights, detainees endure other brutal measures, such as deprivation of contact with their families and daily insults. In many cases, torture results in permanent disability, in injury, pain, coma, and loss of consciousness. The Saudi prisoners are denied the right to medical treatment. The report added that Munir al-Adam, a young man who was executed along with 36 other men on 23rd of April 2019, lost his hearing because of torture, and Abdullah al-Tarif, another young man who was executed in the same mass execution, was also tortured. Torture caused damage to Abdullah al-Tarif's spinal vertebrae, as well as deviation of his left eye, and other parts of his body were also harmed. Agence France-Presse explains more about the same story. A Saudi court of law has sentenced 10 Egyptian men for up to 18 years for trying to organize a remembrance event for the 1973 Arab-Israeli war between the Tel Aviv regime and a coalition of Arab states led by Egypt and Syria. Two relatives speaking on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisals said that the court found the men from Nubian ethnic group guilty of establishing a terrorist group. The Egyptian men were first arrested in October of 2019 for trying to organize the event. They were released without charge in December of that year, but were rearrested the following July. The relatives of the men said, "I have intense anger at the extreme injustice to which our people have been subjected." The relative said one man received an 18-year sentence, one was jailed for 16 years, two were jailed for 14 years, and the others for between 10 and 12 years. Human rights groups had previously campaigned for the men's release and denounced the proceedings against them as a travesty of justice. They said the men were being prosecuted for the peaceful exercise of their right to freedom of expression in trying to organize a community event. Activists said the men had been denied regular family contact and only allowed access to government-appointed lawyers, and that at least two of the men are elderly and in a state of poor health. The relative said three of the men are over 60 years old. Prominent human rights group Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies, in a Twitter post, denounced recent sentences as harsh. Democracy for the Arab World Now, a US-based advocacy organization, also said the rulings were unfair. The report comes amid Saudi Arabia's back-channel attempts to normalize diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime. The website of Middle East Eye covers the same story, but from a different angle. A group of human rights advocates voiced concern that the British government may be complicit in human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia, citing lack of clarity over what the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund supports in the kingdom. In a report published recently, some campaigners said that at a time when the human rights situation is deteriorating in Saudi Arabia, uncertainty about what the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund is supporting in the kingdom raises questions about whether Britain is bolstering institutions involved in the abuses. The report added that the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund, which has so far given £70 million to six Persian Gulf states, has been criticised by members of parliament and by human rights groups for leaving the public largely in the dark about how it is run and taxpayer money is spent. The latest report comes as women's rights are removed from a description of what the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund supports in Saudi Arabia, a week after Riyadh sentenced a Leeds University student and women's rights activist to 34 years in prison for following and retweeting the critics of the kingdom on Twitter. In June of last year, the British government published the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund's supports, saying it bolsters the strategic partnership and delivers mutual prosperity and security by supporting Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030 reforms across priority sectors in line with British values, including women's rights. But in the Saudi Arabia section of the news summary published on 26 of August, a week after Salma al-Shahab's 34-year prison sentence over her tweets made headlines, women's rights are no longer referenced at all. Lina Al-Hathloul, head of monitoring and communications for the human rights group Al-Aqsd, said the newly published summary still doesn't provide clear and transparent answers and questioned how the Persian Gulf Strategic Fund is supporting human rights in Saudi Arabia. Dana Ahmad, West Asia and Persian Gulf researcher at Amnesty International, described the fund extremely concerning, saying Saudi Arabia's dire human rights record of silencing dissenting voices, executing individuals and ruthlessly crushing basic human rights of citizens and residents needs to be thoroughly addressed.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.